in conflict, which is obviously when often this comes up, especially in war where we have massive conflict, each side believes that truth and right is on their side. So that it's very difficult to reason with each side because each side believes that right and truth is on their side.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. And before we begin, I would like to take just a moment to honor the occasion. This is our 100th episode of Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch. It has been a pleasure and a privilege for me to be involved in this for as long as I have. And my hope is that these conversations enrich the psychoanalytic discourse. Thank you for listening. My guest today is Dr. Ronald Doctor. Ronald is a psychoanalyst and he is a forensic psychiatrist in London. He is a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He is the chair of the IPA Committee on Psychoanalysis and the Law. He is a board member of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy. He has edited two books, one, Dangerous Patients, A Psychodynamic Approach to Risk Assessment and Management, and the second called Murder, A Psychotherapeutic Investigation. He's also published History, Murder, and the Fear of Death. Our conversation today is about the crisis we are in, the crisis of othering. As you can tell from our title, Splitting in Our Political and Cultural Discourse, Psychoanalytic Considerations, we're looking for a way that psychoanalysts can contribute to this state of othering that we are living in, where not only do people have opinions, which is satisfying, fun, useful, and creative, but we have enemies. We have more enemies than opinions. We have others. And it's the kind of othering that we're in discovering and encountering is othering that says it's okay to harm the people who think differently, that differences warrant destruction, that there isn't a tolerance for ambiguity, much less empathy, that differences are to be done away with. And we end up asking, what can we do? And Ronald and I come up with some ideas, but we also end up by asking our listeners to share with us what they think needs to be done or can be done. Not taking sides, we all have various sides, but how do we observe the process so that we can introduce listening to the social political discourse? I hope you find this thought-provoking. And I hope you contribute. You can write on the Facebook page. You can write on the website that this podcast is on. It's called ipaoffthecouch.org, one word, of course. And we would love to hear from you because many of us are interested in actually taking steps to try to change things. Here's my conversation with Ronald Doctor. Ronald, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here. It's especially nice to have you here because this is the 100th episode of the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast, and it's a pleasure to share it with you. Ronald, I interviewed Harriet not long ago, Harriet Wolf, the new president of the IPA, and she told a story about what led her to be interested in running for office. And it was when she learned about a law in Poland that made it illegal to say certain things about the Holocaust, to speak freely about it. And she described having a personal sense of outrage and also feel that psychoanalysts need to have a place in the face of such censorship. Well, we know that censorship is widespread nowadays, and we live in a world where there are groups who crave homogeneity, and they fear the other. And for some groups, the other that they fear are those who look and speak differently from them. And they wish these groups harm. And there are groups who crave homogeneity, and they too fear the other. But for them, the other are those who think differently from them, and they too wish them harm. And perhaps it's not surprising that when each group is confronted with their othering mindsets, they each claim that they are not guilty of it, but the other is guilty of othering. Not surprising. About a year ago on this podcast, it was actually episode 66, for those who are interested, and I recommend it. It's a very thoughtful sharing with Werner Bolivar. For those who don't know Werner, he's an analytic scholar who's devoted his life's work to studying othering, mostly in Europe, and especially around the anti-Semitism that is increasingly pervasive. And he, like Harriet, feels that analysts must have a voice. We must do something, not just think and talk among ourselves, but do something in the face of this pervasive othering that is taking place all around the world. And Ronald, I thought you would be an excellent person to speak to about this for a number of reasons. You're not only a practicing analyst, but you're a forensic psychiatrist. You're also from the UK, and you can bring an international perspective. We in the States often think that our world is the whole world, and we miss out on a lot, and you're going to help us with that because you do have an international perspective. You've also published and thought a great deal about this in this area. You chair the IPA in the Law Committee, and you also run Balint groups. And we're going to discuss Balint groups and how they fit into this plan. But start us off with your work in the IPA in the Law. What does that committee do? What has it done? And what is it planning on doing going forward? And then we'll work our way back into this othering experience.
Right. Hello. Firstly, as said, I've become chair of the IPA and Law Committee since September, so I've only been the chair since for a few months, but I was a member for the past 4 years, and the main thing we did was to produce a book, which I will give you the titles, which is Psychoanalysis, Law, and Society, published by Routledge. And it was edited by Plinio Montagna, who was the chair in the first 2 years of my membership, and then Adrian Harris, who was chair for the second 2 years. And it has 20 contributions by 20 different analysts on issues related to psychoanalysis, law, and society. It was published in 2019. And we're now in the process of producing another book more related to psychoanalysis, law, and the COVID epidemic. And we'll probably have another 20 chapters with 20 different psychoanalysts contributing to this book. We've also had a few webinars talking about psychoanalysis and law in relation to the courts, which I contributed to. And The other main issue is commenting on a number of social reports put out by the IPA. First one was on racism and prejudice. And the second one was physical punishment on children. And we've made a contribution and comment on both of those issues. We are meeting soon to try and take it forward and to decide what other items we might add and what people might be doing in their different countries. We have members from India, Europe, North America, South America, and we're going to decide how further to take this. How are we going to take this forward?
Which brings us to our topic today. You and I came up with the title of our topic called Splitting in Our Political and Cultural Discourse, Psychoanalytic Considerations. But we made a point to put quotation marks around the splitting. And the reason for that, I think, is an important one. That is, splitting is something that we observe and study, immerse ourselves in, and know within ourselves as well, on the couch. Mm-hmm. And when we translate to off the couch, to large groups, which is so beautifully written about by Vamik Vulkan, the large group phenomena, we can identify splitting being a phenomena, but I think we should note that it's splitting in parentheses. Splitting really belongs in the intrapsychic space as opposed to the large group space, but it so usefully captures certain types of large groups that we're going to discuss that I think it's fair to use it as long as we note that we're aware of the difference between the individual and the large group. So tell us about splitting and how you think that captures this moment, whether you call it othering or splitting. Tell us.
Okay, so I always think, and I'm sure a lot of people will know this, but splitting I always think is associated with projective identification. Klein described the paranoid schizoid position with its known defense mechanisms of, as you've just said, splitting and projective identification. And so that once gets one we get, all get rid of our bad aspects, projected into either the organization or the other person, and then get rid of them. And you know, these are the unwanted aspects of ourselves, which we split off, project into the unwanted, and the other person becomes the unwanted because we don't want them. Now this is. And it's related to my second point, which is I'm going to quote from my analyst, as he always quoted it, Eric Brennan, when he said that in conflict, which is obviously when often this comes up, so it could be as and especially in war where we have massive conflict, each side believes that truth and right is on their side, so that. It's very difficult to reason with each side because each side believes that that right and truth is on their side.
And here we are. And just to make the distinction about large groups, you were describing the primitive, the paranoid large group. I tend to think of it like being a football fan, whether it be American football or the rest of the world football, we all know what it means to be a fan of a team. And I certainly enjoy it when my team wins and it beats the other team. And there's a sense of personal triumph when that happens. People often say, we won the game, right? Even though we didn't play, we won the game. Yes. But at the same time, there is a camaraderie with the other team's fans. There's a pleasure in enjoying the game. A well-played game is a pleasure for both sides, win or lose. And there's, if you want to call it something, we can call that a depressive position, large group phenomena, where there is an empathic affiliation with the other side, as opposed to a wish to destroy the other side. And that's the pivot point we seem to be at in our political and cultural discourse, where it's splitting and not empathic and relating. And the question is, what do we analysts do in the face of this? We can't just sit and watch, and we can't just work in our office, as vital as that is. we must somehow figure out a way to take what we've learned from working in our office. And I and many have the privilege of working with people of all political persuasions, including the extremes on both edges, and to learn to listen to the process and to listen to what's underneath their loud voices and to help them tune into their softer voices.
Yes, I think, I mean, often when you talk about doing something, I think the probably what where I have spent a lot of time in doing is in what I would call the balance groups, or another name that's given is reflective practice groups. The balance groups are usually were done for GPs, but it's now, in fact, the groups I have are both GPs, junior GP trainees and psychiatric trainees, and also senior GPs and psychiatric trainees. And where I listen, they present patients and all complex organizational difficulties they're having in the hospital. And obviously then we have a discussion. And I think it's the discussion, not so much what I say, but the sort of a discussion and debate about what the problems are. So once the person is presented, I think that's what's often lacking, is a sort of discussion. That the two sides, that the different people can offer different opinions about what they feel. I often put the point across that if they use their countertransference feelings and thoughts that come up while they're listening, emphasis on listening to the presentation by one of the doctors, they might have very different feelings, and I often impress this upon them. They will all have different feelings and thoughts dependent on their personal history, but also what the effect of the person presenting the problem is having on them. And it's very interesting that they often come up with very different feelings and thoughts. And then the debate is held between, which I think is the thing that's lacking in often political, they're not always, but often lacking in political discourse. Just to add to this, I suppose politicians sit in parliament in the UK with they do listen, and they have to listen to each other. The point is often to disagree with each other, but at least they are talking to each other, which can be more, which obviously must be a good thing.
You mentioned listening, and when I speak to analysts who are working off the couch, one of the things I ask them is, so what is it that you bring as an analyst that's unique to this work that you're doing? Because many people do the work and they do it very well, but there must be something different. And almost everyone responds with some reference to, I listen differently. In fact, there's an interview scheduled with Heli Morales, who is the winner of the last Sigourney Award. He is starting what's called psychoanalytic listening clinics throughout Mexico. And I was so moved by the title, psychoanalytic listening clinics, for people to come in and be listened to. And perhaps that's something we can offer. We can offer the ability to listen as analysts listen, not with our own axe to grind, not with what we think the correct political or cultural answer is, but to listen to what other people's experiences are. And perhaps they're being listened to, they will take in an ability to listen to themselves and perhaps to listen to others.
Yes, I would. I think that the listening, well, the way I see psychoanalytic listening is to do exactly what Freud said. He said to us, that the one thing you have to tell the patient is to encourage them to free associate. I don't know how important that is amongst analysts, but I regard that still as one of the fundamental rules of psychoanalysis. Ask the patient to free associate and bring dreams. That's the only instruction you give a patient. But he also said that the analyst who's listening gives a sort of, I think this phrase was a free, the word free again, free floating attention.
Yeah. Now they call it reverie is the term people use. Right.
Yes. And I think that's the important part, because I encourage, when we're sitting and listening in the balance group, I tell all the doctors just to listen and think what thoughts are going on in their mind. How are they free associating to the material presented? It could be a patient, could be a problem in the organization with the managers. And then when that comes to the discussion, to let us know what were they thinking about, what do they feel? Do they feel sorry for the patient? Do they feel angry with the patient? Do they feel sad about it? And you get all the different feelings. That's what's so interesting about it, that everyone often, not everyone, but there will be some people who will feel depressed, some sad, some people who feel angry, others will feel annoyed, and some others will feel bored, say. And I think in their free-floating attention, if they've listened to what their feelings, we can then have a discussion, and they should feel free to talk about them. I always tell them, please do not ask the presenter any further questions, because you're not going to get you're going to get more information from your free association to what you've been listening to from the patient, from the presenter. And this is in the Ballin group. And obviously I practice the same in on the couch, but this is I'm talking about when I'm listening to the groups of doctors trying to talk to us about what's going on with in their work.
So tell me if I hear you correctly. You're suggesting that in the face of individuals who have, let's say, strong feelings, some they're aware of, some they're not, what we analysts can bring is an attention to process. That's what we do. And reflect back the process on them so that they can learn more about what they're feeling beyond the manifest.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the question is, if we were to carry that methodology, again, outside the office to the political, social, cultural arena.
Yeah.
What form could that take? What could we do to add just a little bit of that kind of understanding to people who are actively involved in othering and censoring both?
Well, I think that psychoanalysis often has this sort of, you know, we'll tell them what to think, you know, that what we are saying is rather than hearing the, allowing each person, because this is, you know, because often this is what, you know, the people are afraid to talk, but everyone is allowed to say what went through their mind as they were listening to whatever the problem is. And if they can feel free to just say what's in their mind, no matter if it sounds politically incorrect, which is one of the, or if it sounds wrong, but they are allowed to say that this is the discourse I encourage, not to hold back because it sounds wrong or it won't be accepted by the others, but this is the thoughts were going on in their mind. And obviously, I, as the psychoanalyst, will have my own thoughts and try and link what I'm hearing, not only from the presenter, but then also from the discussion. I think the discussion is very, really important, and often it's very interesting how during the discussion, my listening and my thoughts and feelings that I come into my mind, and obviously I'm listening. To not only the presenter, but to everyone else, we do come often to a very clear formulation of what the problems are without me prescribing what they should think or not think or some sort of lecturing to them. It's rather a discussion that we, out of a sort of discourse between us all. There might be 12, 15 in the group. We all come to something that feels... and obviously, I might have more experience of it than junior doctors do, and therefore are able to perhaps give my own impressions of it.
But let me ask you a question. There is an ease with which you and I think about inviting people to say their mind, whatever comes to their mind, if they imagine it's offensive or forbidden or disturbing or repugnant, because that's the model we use in the office. But we have to be sensitive to the fact that out of the office is not the same as in the office. And you can't and shouldn't say whatever comes to your mind anywhere else but your analyst's office, especially not in front of other people. So how do we temper that? How do we make that that ideal of free association available in settings like you were just describing, a Ballin groups? How does that work?
I tell them that I'd start off by saying, I always say this in every balance group, I say, please don't ask any questions to them, because the information you get will be not that helpful. And I usually let them ask one or two questions, and it usually leads nowhere. And then I say, okay, rather than asking questions, if you could just tell me what was going on in your mind. And they will say, some will say, I felt absolutely furious with this person for doing this or that. Others will say, I felt really saddened by what I was hearing, and I have a few thoughts about that. Some will even say that, it reminds me of my family, that my family has suffered something very similar to this, and it's really very, makes me feel very sad and sympathetic to this person. Others will be very annoyed with the person, but they do feel able, if you just tell them that this is the form we want to work with. I've spelled it out that this is going to be more helpful than asking they're very keen to ask questions in the beginning, as if that somehow will reduce the answer.
It does. Right, sure.
And so that's the way I think it's about having faith that somehow a conglomerate of feelings, because everyone will have slightly different ones, that you believe a bit in what each person has to say, and faith that it will help us come to some formulation. And it usually does. That's the interesting thing.
Well, let me challenge us, because okay. I'm taking literally the mandate that you and I came up with, which is, what can psychoanalysts do in the face of these othering cultures that we're buffeted by? And, we analysts like to talk to each other and to theorize, and that's useful and necessary and obviously not sufficient. And the question is, how do we take the product of our joint thinking and move it outside the office into the social, political, cultural arena? And your work in Ballant is an example of taking analytic thinking and applying it, in that case, to the medical setting. Mm-hmm. I have heard people request Ballant-type groups for teachers who, heaven knows, are under enormous stress, and I could see it being very useful for them.
Yeah.
And the question is there something in the political arena that we can bring? Not that we're going to change people's political points of view, I can't imagine, but I guess the best we can hope for is to suggest, maybe by our presence, that the other isn't so dangerous or repugnant that you have to live your life wanting to destroy them, that you can sit in the same room with the people you deem other, and you share more than is different, and we hurt about the same kinds of things, and we're afraid of the same kinds of things, and we can share that. And if we can introduce that possibility to people, and I'm cautious about being naive about this, but it's worth a try. What do you think? What kind of forum or possibility could this exist in?
I think the one experience I've had was in a violence. It was called a violence workshop. So there were about 10 of us, all psychoanalysts, trying to think about violence. And the clinic that we were working in was a clinic which many patients with violent backgrounds of assaults or paedophilia or some sort of sexual violence were referred. And we did run the violence workshop invited people who were working, it's in the civil service, having to mm-hmm. advise politicians about certain laws that they had to pass or formulate, and often to do with violent offenders, whether they should, what sort of treatment they should have, or how could we understand them? How could we help the politicians come up with new laws? And they were very interested in coming to hear presentations because someone would present a patient who had committed a violent act, and try and think with them about how to understand the violence that was being perpetrated. Now, this might be, I know that, I'm sure that other people have talked about, I mean, in the UK, there's a problem of gang warfare. And, every sort of few weeks, there will be someone has been knifed, some stabbed and killed. And it's sort of endless, and no one seems to really know what to do. And maybe that this could be people who are having to devise the laws and, you know, as to what to do with this. A group could be set up of trying to think with them, of presenting the problems and trying to think, as I've just described in the Ballant group, about what, how to understand this. Is there ways of trying to control it? I mean, that's probably a big subject, but it is a sort of current problem that's just come to my mind. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Without knowing it, you represented an international point of view. How? When you said that in these gangs, they knife each other. Because here in the States, people don't knife each other. They shoot each other. On a daily basis in just my city, Philadelphia, people are shot daily. Yes, I know. It's a special American phenomenon.
Yeah,
You have the good fortune of suffering in a culture where people are only knifed.
Yes, yes.
So the question is, and we're obviously not going to come to an answer, but we're going to pose a problem, a challenge better, of what we analysts can bring to this othering world that we're in. And perhaps it would be useful if we don't pretend to have an answer, but take seriously the question and the challenge and invite people who listen to this to share with us what they think, analysts and therapists of all stripes, what many people can bring to deal with the other and to address the process, not to get into rehashing of which side is more virtuous than the other side, because we know where that leads. We're talking about the underlying need to other people. And I think your Ballant idea is absolutely wonderful. And the possibility of doing such a thing with political staffers, for example, of all persuasions and all parties, an inspiration for this kind of thing is, of course, the work that many people have done, but Lord John Alderdice was very active in dealing with that with the Irish situation, and to very good success. He and I had a wonderful conversation describing just that. But not all of us can operate on that level of negotiation, and we can think together about how we can take that and bring our analytic listening and to share it with others and to have them be listened to as we were listened to as analysts. And that's how we learned to listen, by being listened to. And it enabled us to listen to ourselves and to listen to others. And we can share that, not by analyzing everybody, but by listening as often as we can.
I would agree that. I know Mr. Alderdice. There's a conference, I think, there's a conference coming up. Can I advertise?
Yes, please do. Sure.
There's a conference coming up, and I think you might have had one of these with Corinne Min, who we are both on the board of the International Association of Forensic Psychotherapy, and Lord Alderdice is also giving a talk. And it is about violence, actually, and the effects on communities and I'm not sure what the exact title is, but it is the main title being violence. Oh yes, violence, a global emergency, which I think it has become. And obviously, this issue will be discussed at length over this.
Amazing. Well, let's close on that note, but it's only the door isn't shut. The door is being kept open, and it's to invite further thought, not only from you and I and others involved in the IPA administration and committees who are all trying to make outreach outside the office, but also to others who are listening. And if they have suggestions, ideas, we can start a forum. It could be on Facebook. It could be on the IPA website. It could be on the website that this podcast is on, is called ipaoffthecouch.org, and there's room to write comments.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can start a conversation that will lead to action, that will actually lead to us doing something to try to change this disequilibrium we're in, where, to go back to our title, where splitting is considered normative.
Yeah. Yes, no, I think that would be a very good idea, Harvey, and I look forward to hearing other people's points of view and what they might, how they would think about this. And yeah.
Terrific. Ronald, a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you. Thank you for your work. I look forward to our working together on our various committees. And please, when your next IPA and law book comes out, give a shout out and we could post it on our Facebook page and we'll let the community at large know about it.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.